Hi, I'm Heather Mulder.
And I'm Janice Greeno, and you're listening to Dementia Untangled, where we explore the topic of dementia through conversations with physicians, experts, and community leaders.
Our discussions focus on innovative ideas, practical strategies, and proven methods to guide caregivers along a supportive path.
Hello, and welcome to Dementia Untangled. Thank you for joining us for this episode of our podcast.
Today, our conversation will be with Dr. Craig Weinkauf, a vascular surgeon and immunologist, and we will be discussing the effects of carotid artery disease on brain health. The carotid arteries are the two major arteries which carry blood from the heart to the brain, and major causes of carotid artery disease includes the buildup of plaque in these arteries, and it usually begins in early adulthood. Things that can increase your risk include high blood pressure, diabetes, smoking, and high cholesterol. Oftentimes, the first sign that you have carotid artery disease could be a stroke or a TIA. What really stood out to me about this information was that carotid artery disease can start happening in early adulthood. And often these early signs of it can be modifiable risk factors. Some of our listeners may remember a study that came out in 2017 by the Lancet Commission that stated that nearly 40% of dementias are potentially modifiable. And they looked across the lifespan and identified things like, and this list is going to sound familiar, smoking, diabetes, physical inactivity, all of these contributors to carotid artery disease are potentially modifying your risk for developing dementia as well.
Heather, first of all, it's just such an honor to have vascular surgeon Dr. Weinkauf with us today. And so often when our colleagues and physicians are sharing out in the community, they wrap up what you just said in a few short words, and they say, what's good for the heart is good for the brain. That exercise, diet, stress reduction make a huge impact. But before we get started today, I just want to take a moment to say thank you from the many families like mine who deeply appreciate vascular surgeons who have given their loved ones the gift of life and more time with our loved ones. So before we even get started, I want to say thank you, Dr. Weinkauf, for that. And thank you to your colleagues. And we're so excited about this conversation today.
Thank you so much for having me. I greatly appreciate the opportunity to see what you guys are doing, hear more about your podcast, as well as talk about my research here at the University of Arizona.
Welcome, Dr. Weinkauf. We're excited to learn more, but before we learn more about the work that you're doing, I would like to learn a little bit more about you. Could you tell us about your journey and what led you to connect to the dementia community?
Yeah, although it is intimately entwined with the research, I'm as you said, I'm a vascular surgeon. My background is that I did a MD PhD at Tufts University, which is in Boston, and I studied, I did my PhD in immunology. As time went on and I had to figure out what area of medicine I was interested in, I was drawn to vascular disease because there's so much underpinnings of immunology related to the disease process, as well as the fact that surgery is an area where you can identify a disease or a problem or something that is affecting your patient and really have an immediate beneficial effect for them in their life. Vascular surgeons, as many involved with this study, help take care of people. We help them improve their quality of life, ensure they're able to walk. And what's interesting with this project is, in a way, this is the application of the day-to-day life and that of my patients that I see, and trying to rethink what that might mean for their brain in regards to how their blood supply is affecting the brain itself, which is quite a new concept for our field.
I think that's such an interesting story. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about what exactly carotid artery disease is.
As people age, usually associated with genetic predisposition combined with modifiable risk factors that you already talked about, like smoking, diabetes, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, in conjunction with mechanical factors. So I'll explain that a little more, but those three main areas result in having atherosclerosis, and it can occur in many areas throughout your body. The mechanical part of it is interesting because even though you're at risk of developing atherosclerosis throughout almost any area of your body that has blood vessels, it generally occurs more commonly in certain areas. And the carotid artery bifurcation is one of these areas that are very common, as well as very important, because these are the main arteries that provide blood supply to the brain. The atherosclerosis itself, it's probably easier just to think of it as a buildup of plaque. This is a mixture of generally lipids as well as cellular expansion that leads to a plaque buildup and can cause blockages in your arteries.
Thank you for that explanation. And I'm wondering what the symptoms of carotid artery disease are and what would bring someone into your office?
It's a little unfortunate, but in general, the vast majority of patients with carotid artery disease are asymptomatic. Now, there are some screening programs and people who have risk factors who do get screened with ultrasound. Ultrasound can visualize the carotid arteries and help quantify if there's a plaque buildup there. But quite often, patients do not have symptoms, or at least no major symptoms that bring them to their doctor's office. Roughly 90% of carotid disease is asymptomatic. And it's an important concept for my research, that word asymptomatic, because as I treated more patients, and many of my colleagues felt the same way, that even though we call this asymptomatic disease because it's not causing an overt stroke, that is the main issue that we treat with carotid disease, is stroke, and we focus on stroke prevention clinically. That occurs because small pieces of the carotid plaque can break off, embolize, and go to the brain, therefore causing blockages distally, and therefore your brain doesn't get blood. That's what an embolic stroke is. However, if you're not having a stroke, then we call that disease asymptomatic. The interesting thing, though, is that over time, myself, like I said, as well as several colleagues, noticed that our patients, even though technically they were asymptomatic because they weren't having a stroke, we also felt that maybe their brains weren't working quite as well, or maybe they were slower than they should be. And, you know, some of our patients would complain about their brain feeling fuzzy or their brain feeling slow. And these are very subjective terms, but in essence, this is exactly where the project started, because we said, hey, this asymptomatic carotid disease probably is not really asymptomatic. How could your brain function normally if it's not getting a normal blood supply? I think a interesting way to look at that is kind of to look at stuff we know probably more about and have been treating longer, and that's your legs. So the same process occurs in your legs. You can have buildup of blockages. And if we think about our legs and walking and how we use our legs, some people use them to go out and get the mail. Some people use them to go on runs, go hiking. All of those things are different, of course, activities that cause and use certain strength of your legs and muscle in your legs, and that all is related to your blood supply. So if you have a blockage in your leg that's, say, 70 or 80% blocked, well, you can sit on your couch and you would never know it. Your leg would be just fine. It wouldn't feel bad. It'd be very unlikely that you'd have any problems at all. However, if you have that same blockage and you try to go on a run, well, then your leg would start to have severe pain. If you went on a hike, your leg would have severe pain. And then imagine even further, if, say, you wanted to run a marathon, well, that would be impossible because your leg would not have enough blood to do that. And the reason why this is an interesting metaphor for the brain is that we know that we have these blockages to the brain. And although there are extensive collateral networks, it's still, to me, a fundamental question to ask, well, what is the brain that's the equivalent of sitting on the couch for your legs? What is the brain that's the equivalent of running a marathon for your legs? And how do we try to figure out what the brain really needs, what's normal for the brain, and therefore also what's normal aging? So all of this is kind of a way to ask yourself, how does the blood supply affect the brain when, you know, unlike the leg, which can give us feedback in regards to having pain, the brain has no pain fibers. So if it doesn't have blood, it can't send a message that says, hey, I'm hurting, I don't have enough blood, or this hurts, anything like that. Whereas, of course, our legs can, and therefore we know when our legs are not getting enough blood. So that's kind of a long-winded example, but I think it's quite interesting in trying to figure out what's a brain look like when it's running a marathon, and what type of blood supply does it need?
I love that analogy, the brain equivalent of running a marathon. You also talked about how carotid artery disease is often asymptomatic. And when we talk about dementias and specifically Alzheimer's disease, we know there's this extended period of time where the person is asymptomatic. Can you spell out for us how is carotid artery disease related to an increased risk of developing Alzheimer's and other dementias?
I guess the simple answer is no. I can't, because we don't know that for sure. It's my hypothesis that that carotid disease does increase your risk for dementia. There's a lot of evidence that there's cardiovascular underpinnings that increase your risk for dementia, but it hasn't truly been proven that carotid disease itself leads to an increased risk of dementia. We have a lot of preliminary data that support that finding, but the theory for how it might work, even though it hasn't been proven, is that if your blood supply to your brain is inadequate, it leads to increased stress and decreased ability for metabolism and other appropriate functions of the brain. In addition to that, although, like I said, we consider this asymptomatic carotid disease, there's some evidence that people are having small pieces of that plaque break off continually, and that could lead to inflammation in the brain, as well as potential breakdown of the blood-brain barrier. These are all important early steps that have been shown by, let's just say, the dementia field at large to be highly relevant in the development of Alzheimer's disease. But it would be incorrect to really say that we know that carotid disease leads to dementia or other forms of Alzheimer's dementia or other forms of dementia.
This is all so fascinating. And you've shared your hypothesis and a bit about the project, about the research that you're doing in this study. But can you tell us more about this study?
Kind of as I said, it sort of grew out of my patient population and noticing that it really didn't seem like asymptomatic carotid disease is truly asymptomatic. So we started to study and evaluate the brains of several patients in our preliminary work. And that preliminary work was quite exciting. It showed that patients with carotid disease do have a decreased cognition, as well as specific structural changes and structural connectivity in the brain. I can explain what those things mean more as we talk, if that would be useful. But that preliminary work really galvanized our group and helped our group even grow. This project has been really a work of a dozen, if not more, great researchers, as well as at least a dozen vascular surgeons in Tucson. And I think that the input of all of these people have led to us being able to really hone our project and understand where the gap of knowledge is here. So we recruit patients who have carotid disease, as well as controls who have cardiovascular risk factors, but no carotid disease. We study their brains using an MRI. We do transcranial Doppler, looking at if they have microemboli coming from their carotid plaques. And we also do a large battery of neurocognitive tests. We do these at baseline, as well as every year over multiple years. In addition, we also look to see how carotid endarterectomy or carotid stenting affects the brain after this treatment. So an interesting part of the project is that there's already a readily available treatment for carotid disease. It's a intervention dating back to the 1960s and even more so 1970s. In addition, now we have more tools like carotid stenting, but the goal of each one is to either remove the plaque or minimize the plaque, decrease the risk of having a stroke, and very likely increase the blood flow through the artery. So we're able to study these patients prospectively over a long period of time and therefore try to quantify exactly how the brain is changing both structurally and functionally.
Dr. Weinkopf, when I was reading up on this story, I thought it was really fascinating. And you mentioned this too. You have this large team of vascular surgeons, but this is a much broader collaboration. You're engaging neuroimaging experts, MRI experts, neurocognitive experts, and Alzheimer's disease experts all working together. Can you talk a little about why this is so important?
Thank you for that question. I really like to highlight all of my collaborators. You know, the field of Alzheimer's dementia research and ADRD at large, I think, is growing more appreciative of the cardiovascular risk factors that may be related to all, most, if not all forms of dementia. It was probably when I was giving a talk to the Phoenix Banners Alzheimer's Institute group, I was invited to give a talk by Eric Ryman, and he was really instrumental with connecting me to the dementia field. And this project really grew by leaps and bounds when I was able to use the tools and the knowledge that the AD field has already developed and think about those concepts in regards to my patient population. You know, as a vascular surgeon, and across the country, it's the same. You know, we don't treat patients for their brain health. We don't evaluate their brain health. We don't test for their brain health, and we definitely don't treat for their brain health everything outside of just stroke prevention. However, once I started to learn more about and really get a greater appreciation of the AD research field, I was connected with researchers like Jean Alexander, Ted Truard, Maria Altbeck, and then, of course, Dr. Ryman. And this group has really helped expand the power of this project. And, you know, without collaborators, especially this day and age, research is so complicated and there's so many advanced tools that we can bring to bear to help treat our patients, to help better understand our patients, and to also help better understand their diseases. I think it's projects like this that truly show how a collaborative effort can be so strong and helpful. You also mentioned the vascular surgeons involved. You know, these people are my colleagues, many of them my friends. We call ourselves the Arizona Vascular Research Consortium. You know, I may see by myself, say 20 to 50 patients per year with carotid disease. That's a lot of people. However, that's definitely not enough to try to actually answer questions and improve their healthcare. If we want to really move the field forward, if we want to really ask questions about our patients that truly help their life and be able to answer them in reliable, robust ways, we need big groups like this. The Vascular Research Consortium, made up of surgeons, vascular surgeons throughout the Southern Arizona area, you know, we as a group make a much, much larger impact than one person alone doing a study. And that can't be overemphasized.
I'm glad you took some time to share about that powerful consortium and your work with Dr. Eric Ryman, who I know empowers others around the state and around the globe to be collaborative in research. So it's wonderful to hear about the work that you all are doing together. And I'm wondering, you've talked a little bit about the testing that you've done, but I know that you have done some cognitive testing as well, and I'm wondering if you can tell us about that.
Definitely. Cognitive testing is a major part of our research. In our preliminary work, we showed that patients with significant, meaning greater than 50% carotid disease, had an increased, had lower scores on their cognitive testing. For that study, we were using the MoCA. It's called the Montreal Cognitive Assessment. It's more of a screening tool, but it still showed a significant difference. And what was very encouraging about the project, it also showed that over an extended period of time, those patients who had a carotid endarterectomy, which is removal of the plaque from their carotid artery, had an improvement in their MoCA score. That was probably one of the most exciting findings of our preliminary work, because it showed that maybe there's an intervention that can be used to help. Currently, we have a much more developed neurocognitive battery. Within the dementia field, there's a neurocognitive battery called the UDS, and we work with Dr. Gene Alexander and his team to perform these tests on our patients and see how they change over time. Like I said, we do these tests both before surgery and after surgery, as well as in control patients who never have surgery.
You have mentioned the word plaque quite a bit today, and plaque is accumulating and causing carotid artery disease. We also know plaque is accumulating and is one of the proteins that is potentially causing Alzheimer's disease. So we have plaque in our arteries, we have plaque in our brain, we have plaque on our teeth. Is this all the same plaque?
Heather, it all sounds bad to me.
I think probably that's the best way to think about it. It all sounds bad. No, very simply, no, they're definitely not the same plaques. It's interesting. We do use the same word, and it's also funny to think about a plaque from teeth. Now, I don't know what sort of debris is in tartar and what builds up on teeth, but I assume it's not cellular. But anyway, the plaque in the carotid artery is very similar to a plaque that you might get in your legs, as we discussed briefly, also in your heart and in other parts of your body. This is accumulation of lipids in the wall of your artery, and then the inflammatory reaction to that. And that's kind of a generalization, but that gives a pretty broad overview of what this plaque is composed of. You know, there's calcium, there's multiple cell types, there's multiple types of lipids. But this is an accumulation of those components within the wall of the artery. The plaques in the brain, now again, there are many plaques that people talk about. Probably the most common one is beta amyloid plaque. Again, this is a totally different protein. But yes, we use the word plaque. I guess we can just say, you know, anything that's bad, we can call a plaque.
And so when we're thinking about doing something good, what steps should people be doing now to prevent dementia in the future and to have better heart health? What lifestyle factors should they be implementing in their day-to-day life?
I think that, you know, it's not going to come as a surprise for most of your listeners. You know, really getting back to the basics. You know, I tell my patients every day, if you don't use it, you lose it. So for me, exercise, exercise, exercise. You know, Dr. Alexander and many other people have shown that exercise helps your cognitive function, helps your brain over the long period. You know, exercise helps the rest of your body as well. You know, your lungs, your heart, your legs, every single thing. Our bodies were designed for working. Our bodies were designed for exercise. They were designed for moving. You know, I give a lot of attention to exercise because I think the strongest data support that. However, of course, there's other things too. You know, if you smoke, stopping smoking is an important thing. Having a good diet that's balanced, controlling diabetes or preventing diabetes or getting rid of your diabetes through exercise and diet. All of those day-to-day cardiovascular risk factors are important to treat and control. Blood pressure is an area that in the past, say, 5+ years has gotten more attention within the field of dementia. It's very clear that patients who have uncontrolled blood pressure have significantly increased risk for Alzheimer's as well as other types of dementia. And controlling it does appear to help some surrogate markers of developing dementia. For me, though, I always try to go back to exercise because I think that's the most powerful thing and affects everything else. You really can't overemphasize how important exercise is.
I think that's a common mantra that we hear at Banner Alzheimer's Institute from our clinicians as well. You have to move and move more.
Yeah, I agree.
Dr. Weinkopf, before we close our conversation today, could you give us your final thought when it comes to the effects of carotid artery disease and brain health?
Yeah, I think that this is a relatively new field. There's a lot of room to understand how carotid disease and more broadly a blood flow to the brain affects the brain. There's microvasculature, there's macrovasculature, and how all of this contributes to, you know, what I always try to refer to with my patients as brain health, which is a very broad term, is an exciting field. I hope that we can make major advances with my project, as well as many other people in the field studying related topics. And I think it's through collaborative efforts like what is tried to be promoted in the Arizona Alzheimer's Consortium, as well as many other individual people and groups across the Arizona and the nation that can help build these collaborative projects that look at, you know, a problem that we've known and thought about for a long time from a very new alternative perspective. And in addition, using that other field of knowledge can help this one also. You know, here specifically, I think carotid disease is undertreated and probably poorly understood. And I think the dementia field can help our patients. But equally, I think our research can also help the dementia field. And to me, it's all one, but it's interesting to see how these two different, what I consider very separate fields, are now beginning to overlap.
Today, our conversation has been with Dr. Craig Weinkauf, a vascular surgeon and immunologist with Banner Health in Tucson, Arizona. We appreciate you helping us untangle carotid artery disease and brain health.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really been a pleasure. I have liked reading about your guys' group, and I also watched some other podcasts, which I thought were great. Thank you again.
Well, thank you so much. And again, thank you for the work that you do every day and for your leadership in this study. We're just so glad to have had you on the podcast today. And thank you, Heather, for another fantastic conversation. And of course, thank you to you, our listeners. Thank you for joining us. And if you haven't already, please subscribe and share this podcast. I'm looking forward to our next conversation on Dementia Untangled.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Dementia Untangled. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dementia Untangled is hosted by Heather Mulder and Janice Greeno, produced and edited by Amber Ayers, and is brought to you by Banner Alzheimer's Institute and Banner Sun Health Research Institute. We are supported by generous donations to the Banner Alzheimer's Foundation.
Please visit our website at banneralz.org and follow us on Facebook to learn about upcoming events. If you have questions or comments, please email us at dementiauntangled@bannerhealth.com.